appeasement. It's a term we've been hearing more of as the debates on the administration's Iraq policy continues. Our linguist Jeff Nunberg has been tracing the history of this term and has these thoughts.
The English philosopher Peter Strawson used to talk about expressions that had grown capital letters, as he put it. Those are phrases like the Cold War, the Flood, or the Big Apple, descriptions that have turned into proper names that refer to a specific thing or event. But sometimes an expression gets attached to a particular event without actually becoming a name for it, more like picking up a piece of dirt that it can't scrape off its shoes. Stonewalling, for example. It isn't a proper name, but it always evokes the Nixon administration's response to Watergate. Ditto isolationism or partition. They're each linked to a particular historical moment. Or take appeasement. Whenever it's pronounced, the word conjures up the memory of the British policy of appeasement in pre-war Europe. You think of Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain standing on the steps of 10 Downing Street on his return from the Munich conference in September of 1938 after he'd handed over the Czech Sudetenland to Hitler. "It is peace for our time," he told the press. "Go home and get a nice quiet sleep." That moment had a number of far-reaching consequences, I mean, over and above bringing the world a step closer to a catastrophic war. It sealed the political downfall of Chamberlain, and it revived the faded fortunes of Winston Churchill, who had opposed the Munich decision as a complete surrender to the Nazi threat of force. And it permanently changed the meaning of the word appeasement itself. Before Munich, appeasement didn't have the dishonorable connotations that it does for us. Appease still carried the echoes of the root sense of peace, and its meaning was simply conciliate, bring peace to, or pacify. I mean, before pacify got its feet muddy, too. You recall the verse from the book of Proverbs, "He that is slow to anger appeaseth strife." In fact, Churchill himself recommended a policy of prudence and appeasement toward the Turks when they went to war with the Greeks in 1919. And Roosevelt described Mussolini's conquest of Ethiopia in 1936 as an integral measure for world appeasement. That's the sense that Chamberlain had in mind when he talked about a policy of appeasement. The idea was not so much to capitulate to dictators as to ensure the peace while Britain had time to rearm after the defense cuts that Churchill presided over when he was the defense minister in the 1920s. But no politician since then has been able to talk about appeasement in an approving way. After Munich, the word could only suggest a cowardly capitulation to the demands of tyrants, in the hope that they'll refrain from further aggression. That's why the word is so inflammatory when it's used to describe opponents of the administration's Iraq policy. I've been hearing more and more of this. I counted over 80 uses of appeasement in the press last month in stories about Iraq, three times as many as in the month before. And the other day, Condoleezza Rice gave official sanction to the label on Meet the Press when she likened the Securities Council's actions to the appeasement of Hitler in the 1930s. That comparison obviously isn't designed to bring any allies around. It's strictly for the benefit of the administration's own troops. It's part of a blitzkrieg aimed at seizing the moral high ground, even if you have to roll over history and etymology in the process. Whatever your view of the French and German position on Saddam Hussein, after all, it isn't remotely comparable to the attitude that Chamberlain is supposed to have taken towards Hitler. Let's give him what he wants and maybe he'll leave us alone. In fact, neither Churchill nor any other critic of Chamberlain's appeasement policy ever argued for preemptive strikes on Germany. They simply supported what people would now describe as deterrence and containment, the way the French and British are doing now. With the wisdom of hindsight, of course, you could argue that even that would have been an inadequate response to the threat of Hitler. And if you were mine to, you could say that the Security Council is making the same mistake now that Churchill made in 1938. That is, if you're willing to argue that Saddam Hussein represents the same threat to world security that Hitler did back then. But one way or another, that isn't a conversation that anybody's about to launch, at least outside of history department common rooms. The anthropologist Claude Lévi-Strauss once said that every important event lives two lives. One is history and one is myth. Political language plays a big part in that transformation. It turns the lessons of history into a set of cliff notes. All that complicated historical footage is reduced to a couple of stills. Churchill as the resolute foe of bullies glaring over his cigar, Chamberlain as the archetypal Euroweenie with his striped pants, high collar, umbrella, and drooping mustache. And Munich itself has become one of those words like Waterloo or Pearl Harbor, names that have seceded from the flesh and blood past and taken up a life of their own as moral fables in the popular imagination. If some words have grown capital letters and become proper names, words like Munich are proper names that politics has turned into common nouns.
Jeff Nunberg is currently a fellow at the Stanford Humanities Center. He's the author of the book, The Way We Talk Now. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross.